Evening, everybody. I'm Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. Everybody hear me all right? I didn't know if my host had made amends or not. He picks me up, and we're driving down, and we pull off the freeway, and I've seen every back road in Cedar Rapids before I got to the hotel, and I used to remember when I had to do this because I was trying to avoid a lot of stuff, so I don't know if he's made all of his amends or not, but... If his sponsor's here, you might want to quiz him on that, all right? it's good to be back in Iowa. There's a line in the big book about when you get to amends, and it says that we're like a tornado roaring through the lives of others. And I was born and raised in Iowa, and I had to be over 17 years sober before anyone asked me back. I will qualify myself, but that ought to tell you something, you know. I went to a 35-year class reunion up in Humboldt, Iowa last summer, and, you know, I used a phrase earlier today, how do you know what you don't know, and several of my classmates, by the time I was a senior in high school, were concerned about me and my drinking, and I didn't even wake up to that until probably 1975. I got out of high school in 64, but, you know, because of the power and love of God, and a lot of wonderful men and women who have gone before me, and a lot of strong home groups, I haven't had to have a drink of alcohol since October the 19th of 1982. And the universe is a better place as a result of that. And there were probably a lot of times between then and now that I should have been drunk, and that's probably because of God that I wasn't. I do want to spend a little time qualifying. You know, I was born in Des Moines, Iowa, and I went 16 years before I had a drink, and I went 17 years practicing celibacy, and at 16 I picked up alcohol, and at 17 got introduced to sex, and I've just been pretty messed up ever since. You see, my sobriety now is almost exceeding my first stretch of sobriety. But I was born in Iowa and raised for the most part up around Humboldt, Iowa, and had a dad who was an alcoholic who died of alcoholism in 1985. That isn't what his death certificate said. It said his aorta burst, but I know better. And I got some brothers who still enjoy alcohol and a few other things. It's rampant in my family, and I don't know if that makes me an alcoholic. When it comes to qualifying, I just have to sit down and I have to take a look at two or three simple things, and that one has to do with when I take a drink, do I lose control? And you know, watching my father grow up, I pretty well had made some decisions about I didn't want to drink alcohol. Born and raised in a small town in Iowa. And it's not that he was a town drunk, but, you know, you don't hide much in small towns. Humboldt was a town of about 5,000, and my mother had a business there. She had a nursing home. And it's funny, I when you go back after you've been gone for a long time, I used to think Humboldt was big. And I went back there for my 35-year reunion, and I'm a runner, and I ran the whole town in a short period of time, and it just seemed so big when I was back there. But there were a lot of embarrassing, humiliating things, you know, around my dad's Dan's drinking, and I guess I'd made some decisions, you know, I didn't want to experience that. And when I was about the summer before I was going to be a senior in high school, some buddies of mine convinced me that maybe I ought to drink, and so I did. I got drunk the very, very first time I drank, although the effect produced by alcohol, which I came to love, I did not experience that the first time, but that came very, very soon after. And, you know, I had a hard time looking at me and my alcoholism, and the reason is my body's reaction is so abnormal to alcohol that what I could do is consume huge amounts of alcohol over long periods of time, years and years, and not suffer a lot of adverse consequences. So it's hard to look at the idea that you're an alcoholic because my drinking, that all seemed normal. I still remember when I was about 17 and riding around a car with three buddies of mine. We have a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and I'm driving the car, and I drink a half a case. They drink the rest. Two of them are puking, and I'm looking for more beer and driving the car. And that's because I'm having an abnormal reaction to alcohol, and they're having a normal one. And some of you know what I'm talking about. You can just drink huge amounts of alcohol and get up and function. And so, you know, Bill Wilson's story describes me in drinking. You know, it took an important, exhilarating part of my life. When I think back to the effect produced by alcohol, one of the things that I woke up to not long ago was alcohol was a solution for me. It may have been a problem for some of you, and it certainly caused problems in my life, but my truth is alcohol was the solution to what was going on inside me. And I don't know if it really makes much difference what set up what was going on inside me. I just know that the only time I ever felt normal is when I drank. See, non-alcoholics don't understand that. A real alcoholic understands that. Is when I drank, I felt normal. And when I wasn't drinking, I didn't feel normal, whatever normal was. I just most of all knew that I wasn't comfortable in my own skin in any stretch of the imagination. And went off to college, and my alcohol began to impact my life very quickly. I'd gone to Fort Dodge Junior College, and then I went down to the University of Iowa. And they're real serious about their education down there. And I was real serious about drinking. They informed me after 1 year that I was no longer welcome at that university because of my grades. And I said, okay. Then I transferred to the University of South Dakota, where they embraced drinking perhaps a little bit more. And I went to thank God for the steady habits that I had, because early on I had pretty much been a daily drinker almost from the get-go. And I was a little shy of graduation. The Vietnam War was going on, and I got drafted. And I went to basic training and AIT, and then I got orders for Vietnam. Being a good alcoholic, I went AWOL 44 days. As far as I was concerned, I wasn't coming back, and then I reported out to Oakland. I always remember that. I think I have about 100 people. There were only about three of us that weren't AWOL some period of time. And we got over there, and I spent about 13 and a half months over there, and I also got introduced over there to some other mind-altering chemicals, which, by the way, and all I'll say about that is anything else that I've ever done was always still about my alcohol. I did other things so that I could drink more, plain and simple. I love alcohol. Alcohol has always been my deal, and I got back from there, and I finished up college, and my drinking assumed more serious proportions. Now, I had a good reason, too, didn't I? I'd been to Vietnam, right? So I get a Volkswagen, $150, and a new bride, and I go to San Francisco. It's like Bill roaring off on the motorcycle to, you know, going to make my fame and fortune out there, and I got a good job, and so did she, and gosh, we were living in Alameda on the beach, a $150 a month apartment, and both had company cars, and and life was good. And then what began to happen to me is so well described in the big book, and that is that I began to take a drink, and the drink took me, and then more importantly, is the effect produced by alcohol began to change. And I didn't begin to experience what I had experienced for so long with alcohol, which is that I began, you know, I would drink because it made me feel normal. It made me feel at peace within myself. And I also begin to experience what the book calls demoralization, meaning that you begin to compromise your morals. I was married to a wonderful woman and began to commit adultery and have affairs. And then I moved up to Eugene, Oregon, got a job as a traveling salesman, big Bonneville expense accountant all over the state of Oregon. Finally, about 1975, I came home one day. See, I didn't know this for the longest time, but when it came to AA, what AA has taught me is I must raise my behavior to my conscience. I cannot lower my conscience to my behavior. And when you lead the kind of life that I was leading, and that kind of behavior, and you're trying to lower your conscience to that behavior, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And that kind of behavior would lead to a lot of guilt and remorse and a lot of other things, and the drinking got worse and worse. And I remember coming home one day, and I said to her that I'm out of this marriage. And I moved up to Seattle, Washington, and took another job up there, and the drinking began to get worse along with a few other things. And beginning of the end was I went to Alaska. I don't know how many of you have ever been to Alaska, but Alaska is an alcoholic's fantasy. Bars close for 1 hour. The summer, you have 24 hours of daylight. That gets a little confusing sometimes. The only great thing in that was that hour they were closed. You knew if it was daylight and you went to go, and you said, oh, okay, it's 4 in the morning. But it got awful confusing. Then the winters, it's pitch dark, and then that gets confusing. But that was the beginning of the end. I worked up there 8 or 9 months, and I was traveling all over Alaska calling on banks, and most of that was a blackout drinking. The man I'd worked for many years thought a lot of me, finally came up and let me go, and as I said, that became the beginning of the end for me. I went back to Colorado, and from there it was just a series of more and more drinking, and can't quit drinking. And again, I don't know about the rest of you, but I still remember so clearly when alcohol stopped working, but I can't not drink. And you're in that horrible place. And, you know, it's getting worse and worse. I understand the line in the book about a tornado. You know, I don't kid myself about the harm that I put out in the universe. Every human being who loved me and cared about me, I broke their heart time and time and time again. I used to say that when I drank, I was an animal. And someone corrected me on that not long ago. They said, "Mark, I've never known an animal act that way. They have more dignity." So, I apologize to all the animals that I have insulted. Because that's the truth. Animals have more dignity than when I drank. And I had some brothers that were doing some illicit activities, and they enlisted my aid in that. And I continued to drink, and I continued to deteriorate on a daily basis. I'd stay up 5 or 6 times. You know, there's a line when you're looking for, in the big book, about the main problem centers in the mind instead of the body, in pages 23 to 43. And Camille talked about the jaywalker, and I'll just share one incident with you. I'd been up for 5 or 6 days, and I was living with a gal who was a paramedic, which is the only reason I'm standing up here. And I came home, and I went into respiratory failure. And those of you who have seen the movie Pulp Fiction, I about lost it when I went to see that movie, because what happened was my heart stopped, and being a paramedic, she grabbed a big nitrile of nitro and jammed it in my chest. For those of you who aren't done drinking yet, that is one rush, I got to tell you. And I sat up, you know, and I looked down, and a big needle sticking out of my heart, and my body's just flushed with this stuff. And of course, you know, hey, what's happening, you know? I had another time that I was living with a gal, and she had a young child, and I went to the store for milk, and I wound up in Jacksonville, Wyoming, which was 800 miles away, for 9 days. And but when I came back 9 days later, I came back with milk. And I wonder why she's so upset. You know, I had a lot of losses in time, linear time, but it just got worse and worse and worse. And that's a lot of what it was like, you know, stealing from people, lying to people, and the list went on and on. And that horrible thing that happens inside you can't die, you don't want to live, you don't have any answers, the dreams are all gone. And if you're like me, you're saying, you know, I wouldn't raise this. What's going on? I remember I had a grandmother I loved dearly in 1978. I'm up in Alaska, and she dies. And this is a wonderful woman. And I get on a plane. I got 3 days to get from Alaska to Iowa. And, you know, wasn't that hard to do with an airplane. And I wound up in St. Louis, Missouri, 6 days later. And missed the funeral. And I didn't want to miss the funeral. And I did that stuff over and over again. I could not figure that out. And So, I made a little trip back to Iowa. I was going to stay with my cousin down in Winterset. He was kind of a hippie and liked to smoke a lot of that grass. And I'd always kind of liked him. I was going to try and find myself. And all I did was come back and drink even more, along with a lot of the grass, for about 2 months. And poured myself back into Colorado, met a gal, and married her. That was about 6 months before I got sober. And I didn't marry her because I loved her. I married her because I wasn't working, and all I was doing was drinking and really dying. And she said that she'd be willing to take care of me. And we liked that for a while, but then after a while, my drinking became a problem. And so one night, and this is part of my story, one of those evangelical type guys, they go knocking on your door all the time, well, he'd come by the door. And she must have told him about me, because he came back and he started in on me. And I was kind of like Bill Wilson. I kind of figured I had more liquor to outlast his talking, and I did. And he convinced my wife to take me to this church that night. They had some person coming in, and so she took me, very, very drunk. And you know, the insanity of our alcoholism, you know, I don't have anyone in my life then. I mean, in spite of the fact my dad died from alcoholism probably about 3 or 4 months prior to this, I'd gone to walk into the house one day, and he just said, nope, you know, we just can't take it anymore. And you're nothing but walking trouble. And so there wasn't anyone in my life. But I go into this church. It's a huge church. It'll hold like 2,000 people. Church of the Nazarene in Denver. And we go in, and I'm looking around like maybe someone will see me that I know. And I mean, it's just crazy. And I'm sitting in that church, and they do all the things they do. And, you know, here I am. My life is just trashed. Harming everyone I love, and just, and I'm sitting there judging all these people, you know, and but anyhow, they do this altar call, and then I had one of these weird out of body where your body's doing something and you don't want it to do it, but you can't make it not stop, and my body is following all these people down the aisle. I remember this. I'm screaming inside, no, no, don't go, don't go, and my body's going, just going, and I understand about God if God don't want you drinking, and because I was walking down that aisle, and I did not want to be walking down that aisle. And I get down there, and I, you know, I don't know what they did, but there was a tiny little part of me. I pretty well become I'll call it a dirt hard atheist by then. Between Vietnam, a bunch of other stuff, you know, I don't know. Just didn't have much truck with God. And but I said something that night. Matter of fact, later on, about just 2 years ago, I was doing some cleaning, and I came across this. It was a little Bible. And what I didn't realize, and this is an important part of what happened for me, is on that night, I signed that I turned my life and will over to Jesus that night. No recall of that event. See, it's kind of like I'm glad Ebby, 12-step Bill, when he was drunk. See, God don't care if you're drunk. God's God, you know. And so I not only that, I signed this thing, right, that I did that. I normally don't do stuff like that, but I wasn't awake that day. And that was September the 28th of 1982, and I'm here to tell you that the morning of October the 19th of 1982, I came back. My last drunk, by the way, lasted about a year and a half. When I say that, most of the time I was a daily drinker. I tried for 2 weeks. I do not have a history of coming in and out of AA and wanting to stop and whatever. Alcohol was my thing, and if you got between me and alcohol, you left. But I'd gone like 2 weeks. And hit the strange mental blank spot, and a year and a half later, I was separated from alcohol. But that particular morning, something happened. I don't know if it's a moment of clarity. I'm not sure what it is. I can only tell you that a part of me came to know God because something got removed from me that felt like it weighed 1,000 pounds. And that night, I found myself in a treatment center. And I was in horrible shape. Weighed about 240, 250. I had brain damage and kidney damage and liver damage, and wasn't a good deal. But I was glad to be there. And so my experience, in some respects, also is like Bill Wilson's. The power of God removed the obsession to drinking. It has never one time came back at me. Because God does what God does. I told a friend the other day. It's like at some point in time, I think you know, God says, you know, I've been waiting for you to kind of get your act together, and obviously you're not. So bam. And, boy, that's what happened to me. It happened to me then. It also happened to me at 10 years sobriety. And I'm going to talk a little bit with you maybe about my first 10, 12 years in AA. I said this earlier today, but really, and this is the truth, about my first 5 years of sobriety, I do not have much recall of that time period. I just don't. I had really damaged myself from all the years of drinking. And those of you that have some time know this. When you look back over your drinking, if you're like me, the insanity of my life and the depth of my alcoholism was unbelievable to me. I look back and I think about that man and some of the things. When I come back to Iowa, I can't help but think about some of that. I don't have a clue who that man was. And I see what happens to me when I take a drink of alcohol. But somewhere, I can't remember, 3, 4, 5 years, I think I hooked up with a man who was clear on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps, and I certainly wasn't. There's nothing worse than being an Alcoholics Anonymous not having had a step one experience. There's just nothing worse. Am I a real alcoholic? Do I know what that means? You know, to assume that because you drank a lot of alcohol means you're an alcoholic is a dangerous assumption. So that man was able to take me through the big book, and I had a first step experience. I knew what it meant to be a real alcoholic. Went through and did some work. I had a lot of amends. A lot of amends. Took me 3 or 4 years to get through that first set of amends, with the exception of two of them, and I may talk about those when I get there. Then I'll tell you what I did. And I didn't set out to do this, but I did this. So somewhere between 8 and 10 years of sobriety, I think there's a line in the big book Bill Wilson talks about, I needed and wanted God, and He came, but soon the sense of His presence was blotted out by worldly clamor within myself. I can tell you in my first 10 years, I had no meditation life. I did some sponsorship. I was certainly doing some work with pages 84 through 88. But there's a quote that Emmett Fox has that speaks to me. Here's what it says. Knowledge received intellectually provides no nourishment for the soul. The knowledge I was getting in Alcoholics Anonymous and out of books was providing no nourishment for my soul. Action, spiritual living, provides nourishment for my soul. I didn't know that. And right around 10 years sobriety, I was in horrible shape. Horrible shape. I couldn't work anymore. I was reduced to sitting in an apartment. Some friends of mine owned a siding business. And what I did, 2 years prior to this, I was managing three stores, doing $12 million in business to 75 employees. And this is what untreated alcoholism will do for you. All I could do for a living was take flyers to advertise their business and put it in your doorstep and run and hope that no human even opened the door. And there came a day when I couldn't even leave that apartment to go to a grocery store. And so here I am at 10 years in AA, and I don't have a clue what's going on. And so I decide I'm going to commit suicide. And then, you know, God does what God does. I get a phone call from a guy who'd known me quite some time. And he was down in Houston, Texas. He worked at a psychiatric hospital, and he was very intuitive. He called me out. I haven't heard from this guy in 2 years. He calls me out of the blue. He starts talking to me. He talks to me for a long time. He put me on hold about three times. It wasn't a half hour later, a guy's knocking the door. I hadn't seen him in 3 or 4 years. He sent him over there. He knew I was fixing to off myself. And then the guy wouldn't leave. And then about 2 hours later, the guy I'd been talking to in Houston, Texas, knocks on the door. And he goes in and he packs my bags and takes me in a plane and throws me in the nut house. And thank God, saved my life. He absolutely saved my life. And I made a statement earlier today that in that nut house, I really, really took the third step. Really took the third step. Really turned my will and life over to God. Because, see, I had all this history drinking. Then I had this 10-year history in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in that condition that I just described to you. You know, page 52 to the extreme. And I didn't want to live anymore. And so what have you got left? What's left in that? And I started to look at the big book in Nut House. And I, you know, I'm not an idiot. It's a strange feeling being 10 years sober, locked up. And then, you know, they like to be quick to remind you you're not leaving until they deem you can rejoin society, right? And unfortunately, I had great insurance, which terrified me even more. So I got very compliant very quickly. And after about 35 days, they let me out of there. And I went back to Denver and packed everything up and moved to Houston, Texas in 1991. 78 sob and $100 went back. The next 2 years, I did a tremendous amount of work with the first 9 steps out of the big book with some people, various people. Saved my life. I saw that I had never made this a way of living. I saw that I had done half measures in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do know that that works for a lot of people. It just didn't work for me. It wasn't supposed to work for me. And I finally got real clear on that. I finally had to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to pay a lot of attention to the book and stop comparing what anyone else was doing or not doing. And I had to ask myself this question. Is what you're doing working? If the answer is no, then maybe you ought to follow these precise, clear-cut directions. And my life began to change. In 1992, I had never mentioned I'd never done anything with meditation. 10 years sober. And the book is very clear, by the way, if you read it, about meditation. It doesn't suggest you do meditation. It's very clear. It's an instruction, direction. And at that time, when you had the experience I had at 10 years, and you I call it, I died the death of self that day. I really did. You get real open-minded and real willing. And I said, I'm going to do this. And I began a daily meditation life in 1992, and I have one to this day. Today, my practice is I sit 2 times a day for 24 minutes. I will tell you this, of all spiritual practices I've ever employed, meditation has had the greatest impact on me knowing God. Now, because another book says, be still and know that I am God. It does not say be still and believe in God. In meditation, I came to know God. So, it had a profound impact on me. I'm a step worker. I continually work and rework the steps, and I'll tell you why. Because it works for me. I have to stay connected to step one. I mostly want to talk to you a little bit about my life and maybe in the last year. Because I'll tell you something. Outside of working with a new drunk, this is another thing. Spiritual living for me is about being present to this moment. And when I'm working with a new drunk or someone with a lot of time, and I track those people, a lot of time dying of untreated alcoholism, I certainly must talk about my past experiences so that I can help them. But my deal is in my present, right now, to this moment, and to my life, and to everything in my life. That's all I'm concerned about. I'm 53 years old, and most of my life I've been asleep to the present moment. And spiritual living for me today is about being awake, aware, mindful, and conscious of the holiness and sacredness of this breath in this moment right now. And understanding it's all incredible, regardless of what it may look like. So, a little bit about the last year. I also would like to destroy another myth. That is, I'll work these steps and my life will be just great. Last year, about June or so, when I go back to the first 9 steps, I do not take a lot of time. And I had done that in about a month. I sat down with about 12 people. We spent about 5 or 6 hours reviewing the first 3 steps, the first 3 considerations. And we wrote inventory, 10 resentments, 10 regrets. Fabulous inventory. Writing on regrets, 10 fears. Sex inventory, if we had one. We did 5 steps. We met together and did our 6th and 7th step together, made our list, made amends. So I do this holy work, right? So here's what happened to me in the course of about a month. Got let go from a job I'd been at for about 7.5 years. I get a call. My mother was in Denver, and she was getting Alzheimer's. It was getting bad. Had some financial difficulty. Had some physical health problems. This is after doing the work in the first 9 steps, and all this neat stuff's going to happen with me, right? And I share that because that was another idea I had to get rid of. You know, you can't pour new wine in old skin. I don't do these steps today because I'm expecting some great payoff. That isn't why I do them. After I got let go, I went into meditation about what do I do, because I don't know about you all, but I discovered that when you're not working, your income gets cut by 2/3, but your bills don't. So my natural inclination is to get a job. I was born and raised in Iowa. I know about work. I have a great value. I was given a great value. Not working has not been a problem of mine. And what I got for 3 days in a row with guidance is you need to go up to Colorado and spend some time with your mother because she's going to die. You need to go back to that 35-year class reunion. I didn't know what that was about. But see, I'm either going to be obedient. I have conscious contact today. God's will for me is not an ambiguous thing. It's not. I go into the sacred silence 2 times a day. I can hear and understand the will of God in my life clearly. So I did that. And I went up and I spent about a week and a half in Colorado. I'd go sit with my mother. It's interesting, those of you who've ever spent with someone with Alzheimer's, they don't recognize you. And that was kind of a weird deal. I mean, this is my mother. She'd known me a long time. And we'd be sitting there talking, and she'd go, "Who are you?" But what was great was her spirit knew exactly who I was. And she was at a place with her Alzheimer's that she gets scared real easy. She was always real comfortable being around me. So my older brother, he would sit out there and smoke pot, and I'd drink coffee and sit with my mom and talk with my mom. And so I spent about 7 to 10 days out there and saw a bunch of people in Colorado. So then I'm going back to Iowa. You got to keep... This has to do with 2 amends, but it also is about the power of God in your life. And are you going to follow that or not? I've never been to a class reunion. I had made a commitment. I'd gotten a call about 3 or 4 months earlier from 2 classmates of mine that I've stayed in touch with. And they made me promise upon my death that I would be there. And I normally don't make those kinds of promises, but I had done that. So, you know, honestly, say what you do, do what you say. So I said I'd be there. So I'm going to stay up in Humboldt, but I get to Fort Dodge, and I cannot go past Fort Dodge. So I just check in the hotel there. And I mean this, I could not go past Fort Dodge. And part of the story is I had 2 amends left. And that was that back in 1968, I'd known a gal, probably 2-3 years, a friend of mine had dated her. I'd come back from school. We went out over Thanksgiving weekend, drank some alcohol, had sex, and 9 months to the day, a boy was born. They gave that boy my last name, she and I sat down, and, you know, in 1968 in Iowa, trust me, you got married, right? We didn't, decided not to do that, and she asked me to do some financial things, which I agreed to. So many years had passed, and I'd attempted many times to find her and to find my son. To no avail. She'd gotten married, names had changed, people had moved, those kinds of things. It wouldn't leave me. And so what I remembered, though, was I remembered... I can't go past this hotel. I get up the next morning, do prayer and meditation, go down to the courthouse. So I have them pull the file. So they pull a file, and I look, and in there was a piece of paperwork that had her maiden name, or her married name, which I never had. I go to a phone book. There's four names in Fort Dodge, Iowa, last name. Go to the first house, it's deserted. Go to the second house, about 10:30 in the morning. This old boy's sitting outside, got a tooth knocked out, drinking beer. I said, oh, I can talk to this guy. And I get out, and it turns out he's the brother of the man she was married to, who she's now divorced from. And so I get to talking to him a little while, and I picked up on very quickly, in fact, he didn't much care for her. I'm intuitive today. And but he asked me a great question. He looked me dead in the eye and says, is that your son? And I said, yeah. He said, well, he's still here at Fort Dodge. And he said, now, I'm not sure if I know how to get a hold of him, but let me make a phone call. He comes back out and he hands me this piece of paper with his phone number. I said, okay, thanks a lot. Now, I'm not just going to take action on that. That night I went on to Humboldt and I did some more meditation, and the feeling I have is I must find the mother. So I had a sense of the town that she was in, which is this town. So I call, and there's two listings in this town under that name. First one's disconnected, the second one. I call and I say, is this so-and-so? Uh-huh. I said, did you used to be so-and-so? Uh-huh. I said, well, I marked yours to get dead time. And so I told her why I was calling, and we wound up talking for well over an hour. Now, this is how God works. I had been beating myself up for years because I hadn't made this amend. This is about God's timing. It wasn't because I hadn't tried. She and my son hadn't talked in over 3 years. They'd had a little spiff. She didn't even know his phone number. I gave her his phone number. Clean that up. So now I got to clean up my son. So I'm up in Humboldt. So there's a couple, I call a couple times, I get an answer machine. Needless to say, I thought it best I not leave a message. He had seen me one time when he was 3 months old. He's 31 years old. So finally, the third night, I get him. And I say, this is Mark Houston. You know who I am? He said, oh, yeah, I know who you are. And we wound up talking. I wound up making amends. And I basically said to him, I don't know if you want me in your life. And that is your call. And I respect that. And here's my numbers. And here's whatever. Last week, I get a call from my sister-in-law, who lives in Humboldt. Turns out she has a daughter that's working at this hotel. And he's coming in there a lot. He's asked to see pictures, and he wants to know how to reach me. And you know, this program's pretty amazing, but it's about timing. See, there's windows of time, windows of time. And I still get emails back and forth with the woman who was the mother of that child. Those are the last two amends in my state of consciousness that I have in the world. I had a lot of stuff to clean up. I went 5 months without working. I had taken a year off from speaking and doing retreats, which is what I love to do. This is just my own opinion. You know, every other position in AA has rotation. I felt I'd been doing it for 4 years, and since AA wasn't going to rotate me out of speaking, I rotated myself out of speaking. And I took a year off, and it was fabulous. I wrote two books, really did a lot of my own work in so many areas. So that year was over in this time period in which I was laid off, and so I got some calls to go some places and do some weekend retreats in the 12 steps in places I'd never been. And if I'd been working, I couldn't have gone because they were done on short notice. Then another neat thing happened. It's December now, and I haven't worked for 5 months. Now, I've become a better steward of God's money, but my cash reserve was running out. And I was starting to get a little depressed because I'm attached to working. I've worked my whole life. And I had an experience, and some of you may never have thought about this, but you know, when you make your third step decision, there's the relationship of father and child, and I hadn't done this intentionally, but I don't know if I'd ever approach God as his child. And so I want to share with you something I did, and this works, and but I didn't like what was going on with me. Matter of fact, I started to get angry. And I got down on my knees, and I said, Dad, here's the deal. I am your child, and you are responsible. I have sent out well over 200 resumes. I said, I quit, and I hold you accountable. I said, I hold you accountable. You said you'd be responsible. I've done everything that I can do, and I've had all the fun I can stand, okay? I've done everything he asked me to do in these 5 months. I went to Iowa, put my stuff in. You know, I've done it all. And I came at him like a child, and I had never come at God like a child in all the years I've been sober. So now here's what happened. 1 week later, I'm on my knees again. Here's why. I've got two job offers and 24 hours to make up my mind. I don't know which one to take, right?
Jeez.
But if you haven't ever come at God as a child, consider doing that. And I took that job, and I moved up to Dallas, Texas. And a friend of mine bought an 1,100-acre ranch, and he was a chronic relapser, almost died I don't know how many times, and he wanted to help chronic relapsers, and so that's what we do. People have been in and out for years. One guy recently had 18 years, been drinking for six, doctor, horrible shape, came to us, everything's in the back of his car. It's a population of people that, I think sometimes members of AA get scared of. They say things like this, I don't think he wants the program. You know, I got to remember what the big book says. Jim drank several times, and it says in the book, they carefully reviewed with him each time what led up to the drink. I love the relapsers. I love the ones that, because see, the power of God runs so deep. Well, share a little bit with you about how I kind of come at the steps. I do live in the spiritual dimension of the 10th, 11th, and 12th step. You get to the 10th step and it says that we have entered the world of the Spirit. What does that mean? Is there such a thing? What do those words mean? And I can tell you what it means for me. It means having done that work in those first 9 steps, the things that had me blocked from knowing the God within me are removed, and I have an awakened spirit. And my function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness with that awakened spirit as I go throughout my day. 10th and 11th step are full of incredible practices. Many, many practices. Probably only in the last 2 or 3 years that I really begin to do a lot of work with. Incredible stuff. Stuff like watch. Watch is a spiritual practice. You could take one word, watch, and work with it for 6 months. Watch for what? Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. See, when you're asleep, you don't even know what's going on. Ask is a spiritual principle that you can work with. Ask what? Ask God at once to remove it. I've had to practice a long time to be able to ask. It's a practice. Turn. Turn to someone you can help. Get the force away from you. Turn. Turn is a practice. I love the 10-step promises, which, by the way, I've never been able to experience without having done the work to get rid of that which has me blocked from God. I've ceased fighting anything or anybody, even alcohol. Think about what it's like to live in that state of consciousness where you cease fighting anything or anybody, even alcohol. See, that's called freedom. That's called knowing God. That's called not playing God. That position of neutrality the big book talks about, I used to think that was just with alcohol. It's not. It's position neutrality around everything. See? No opinion on outside issues. I don't know, you ever, these school kids, that phrase they use, whatever, used to bother me till one day I realized that's one of the most spiritual expressions I've ever heard. It means I cease fighting anything or anyone. Okay? I have an altar at home, and I got anytime I got a big plaque, whatever. You know? It's a great practice, you know. Well, Mark can't make it. Whatever. Not going to make my amends. Whatever. Doesn't make any difference. See? I'm responsible for one life. That's mine. I'm here to serve God and serve others, but I'm not responsible. So. But the practices of the 10th step are absolutely incredible. How can I best serve thee? The vision of the will. What does that look like? 10th step, line of the will. See, in the 2nd step, I came to see my need to be restored to sanity. In my 3rd step, I made a decision to turn my will to God. In the 10th step, it's proper use of the will. What a fabulous experience to work with the line of the will in the 10th step every day in all the affairs and all the things that you do. It's a fabulous thing to practice. Creativity is coming back in me. One of them is writing. I hope to soon have some books published. To work along the line of the will with that. Thy will, not mine, be done. 10th step talks about a sixth sense. The sixth sense is my awakened spirit, conscious contact with God. You know, there's some fabulous stuff I wish we would talk about more in Alcoholics Anonymous that I think is absolutely incredible. I mean, can you imagine a whole hour meeting devoted to your experience with a new awakened sixth sense, which is your conscious contact with God? Share your experience with that, right? Share your experience with having entered the world of the Spirit. Share your experience with inventory. After you get done writing in 3 columns, there's a line that says, the key to my entire future, I look back. Share your experience with why is that the key to your entire future? Fabulous stuff we could be talking about, right? Because the program is about the power and the love and the will of God in your life. That's what it's about. For me. And a whole bunch of other people that I know. It's about God. It's about power. Tell people, you know, it means we're going to talk about God. That's all there is. Fabulous practices in the 11th step. I do a written review now in the evening. Why? Because I'm awake. When I wasn't awake, I didn't have to do a written review because I wasn't awake. And I like to do a written review. I go back through my day. You know, was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? I write that out because I'm awake today. I can see that as a result of that. So I owe an apology to anybody. But the practice I'm working with was a kind and loving toward all. You know? I, as a group of people, this is my experience, and I'm talking about myself, we're probably the most rudest, most inconsiderate group of people on the planet. And I don't know if it's because of the root of our problem or selfishness or self-centeredness, but, you know, my actions impact other people. And I'm really just getting awake to that. That what I say to other people impacts them. That it really does. Particularly when you got some power, when you got the power of God in you. And if I'm not doing reviews, I'm not awake to those things, if you will. So I love to do a written review. All the 11-step tools. What to do when you get up, a whole bunch of prayers, reminding you to do meditation. 11th step is gives me permission to be quick to see where religious people are right. I had a great experience for me that kind of changed how I looked at, say, sponsorship. And that was when I got moved to Kerrville, Texas. That's a small town, 18,000 people. And I could not find someone in Kerrville, Texas who had done more work than I had done with the book. Experientially. I'm not talking knowledge. So what am I left with? Well, I did some phone contact, yeah. And it was suggested to me that I really begin to work with the 11th step and be quick to see where religious people are right. So I did that. Incredible stuff came my way. A lot of the books of Thomas Merton helped me tremendously. A lot of Buddhism stuff, which helped me greatly with meditation. I met a Native American medicine man. I did some stuff with him for almost 2 years. Got thrust into the order of St. Benedict. Am I being kicked off? Oh, okay. Oh, is that better? You guys haven't heard a word I said. We're going to have to do this again. But all of those practices allowed me to know God. Then, for those of you, let me ask, how many of you would like to have a burning bush? Raise your hand. You're saying, I don't know about this question. The only people that want to have a burning bush are the ones that never had one. April 28, 1996, I had an event happen in my life that lasted 40 days, and it took me 2 years to even get my feet on the ground with it, to even begin to understand it. I know what another book says when it says fear God, and that it's not in a negative sense. The love of God is so far beyond anything that I can comprehend. So for those of you who want a burning bush, well, I don't know if you do or not. I'm only 29 to turn my hair white. The love that I have of God in this program is not of me. AA, spiritual living, is more exciting for me today than it was the day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there's no end to it. There's absolutely no end to it. You know, if you're sitting in this room and your AA and your life is flat, here's the great news. You created that. Now, here's the great news. You find someone who has experience, not knowledge, with the big book. And if you want some things to change, if you want to get taken past here, you go through that process with them again. You can't even imagine what can happen to you. You just can't even imagine. To experience God, you must be out of your mind. We all qualify. So you do not experience God with your mind. God is so outside of anything that my mind would tell me about God. Thomas Merton said it best. They asked him one time about God. He said, when it comes to God, silence makes more sense than words. I love the silence today. I love solitude. My life is truly not my own business. Don said that to me for years, and I did not understand it. And I understand it. There's so much freedom when you understand that your life is not your business. And you give up on your little plans and your little designs. I was telling a pal of mine the other day, it seems like I get sent places. I'm there a year or two or three, and then I get sent somewhere else. So I guess one of the things that I've had to do is realize that, and I've pared my life down, and I have enough great furniture and for a nice one, large one-bedroom apartment. And I got a great computer in there, and I'm zen-like. I'm zen-like. Why? Because when he moves me, he moves me. And I've given up my little plans and my little designs. I for years and a the idea, well, I'm going to find one place and settle down. See, and this is the thing about the ego. When I went back to this 35-year reunion, one of my pals, old Jerry Johnson. I've known Jerry Johnson since 1959. Jerry Johnson married his high school sweetheart, bought a house. He still lives in the same house. He's raised three kids. They're all in college and gone. You might think he's been out of Iowa maybe six times. And I kept in touch with Jerry all through the years, in and out. And Jerry and I are sitting there talking. And I told him, I said, you know, Jerry, I want you to understand how much I have admired and respected you. And, you know, I look at your life. He starts laughing. I said, what are you laughing at? He said, you can't believe how much I've admired and respected you for your life. He said, I've lived through you for years. Thank God you did all the stuff you did. He said, Mark, it was boring back in Humboldt, Iowa. I loved hearing from you. And, you know, where are you living now? And what's her name? And, you know. But it's a beautiful life. Sobriety and knowing God and the responsibility of carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not my message. I work with people out of the big book. And I guess, you know, in closing, you can't have my experience. But one thing I know about God, you know, His grace falls equally on everyone in this room. And if you want to know God more, you can know God more. And the vehicle we were given to do that, as far as I can tell, is East Step. Really sitting down and being willing to go through. There's a line prior to the third step. It says, with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. And I believe that that is possible because of God, not because of ourselves. And the more that self dies, the more I can be of service to God and to my fellow human beings. Now, another friend of mine today, one of the greatest gifts I've gotten, and I've really only come to know this in the last few years, is how I feel inside matches what you see outside. And I don't have to pretend to be anything I'm not. You see? I am as God created me, and that's more than enough. I'm in touch with my human condition. You know? I work with anybody. I have a great time sharing all the mistakes I've made. Boy, I've made them all. And I don't expect to not make them. You do enough work with step six or seven, you'll get stripped of any sense of spiritual pride. If I live to be 90, the day I get up, I'm going to fall short in thought, word, and deed just like you. So who are you to sit in judgment of me, and who am I to sit in judgment of you? You see, I'm against that which separates me from anybody or anything. Love thy neighbor as thyself, and to practice that. My life is blessed beyond belief. I get to travel around a lot. I get to meet new people, a lot of old friends. It's amazing to me sometimes. I am so loved by God, and I so love God. And what allowed me to experience that was I had to drink a lot of alcohol for a lot of years, and then not be able to not drink, and then come into this program, and meet some men and some women who, at times, cared more about me as a child of God than they did about my sensitive alcoholic feeling, who would not lie to me. See, I said this earlier about, you know, some AA families you have to go to. I'm the kind of drunk you don't want to, you could love me to death. That won't work for me. I need somebody coming straight at me. I tell people, I've got broad shoulders and a big ass, bring it on. You know? Don't soft sell it. Don't soft sell it. So those are the men and women in AA that I'm attracted to. I can handle the truth. I can do that. God and His great love, He's got people out there for every single one of us, and He knows what that nature is. He knows the kind of people I need to be around. You know, the Camilles and the Dons and the Big Franks. And He's known the men and women that I need to have in my life to carry the message to me, that I can hear. We all hear different things. And somewhere along the line, pretty soon you realize that you get help from everybody. You get a lot more open-minded. I'm so grateful that you all were kind enough to ask me to come. It has been a fabulous experience. God bless you all. Thank you.